Welcome to the January 7th, 2020 session of TeamSpeak for Tangerine SDR. My name is Dave, KV0S, and a couple things. I have been updating the Tangerine SDR video website. Scotty and Tom's talks were added in the last week, as well as Nathan and Phil Erickson, and then also the whole Ham Sci group was added as a single video. I was able in the listing to put a link so it started in the video where that person starts talking. So if you watch Nathan's, it'll run, and you don't stop it, it'll run all the way through all four. Or you can use the link to jump to each of the other speakers. So that's about it for me. I have been doing some programming, but it's a variety of different projects that I've been working on. So getting back to it, but that's about it for me. Next on the list, we have Dave, KD0EAG. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello. Yes, I've been working on the magnetometer stuff. Not as much as I'd like this week, but a good bit, and mostly on software. I've got everything kind of working, but I don't exactly like the numbers I see, but I'm pretty sure there's some explanation for that. Just moving along. By the way, Dave, you are popping in and out. I don't know if that's just something inadvertent or a problem of some sort. Anyway, I'm just plugging along with the magnetometer and still plan to have a fully functional prototype later, by the end, you know, later on this month. I guess that's it.
Well, fine business, and thanks for the heads up. Next on the list, we have Mike, AA8K, shown as recording, and we thank Mike for posting the TeamSpeak sessions to tsarchive.tangerinesdr.com. Go ahead, Mike.
Thank you, Dave, and greetings to everyone on TeamSpeak.
Okay, and next on the list, we have Nathan, W2NAF. Go ahead, Nathan.
Hi, everyone. How are you? Things are going fine here in Scranton. I've been doing some more work this week organizing the HamSci workshop, so it's coming along. We do have a website up, which I believe everyone knows about. Registration isn't open yet, but we are accepting abstracts, and I sent out some advertisements to the science community today calling for abstracts, and I've been in touch with some of you already about lodging and flights, so that's coming together. Next week, I'll be going to the American Meteorological Society meeting, and I'll be presenting on the needs of the ham radio community from the space weather community and vice versa. And so I posted to both HamSci and Tangerine SDR asking for some information about that, and I got some nice responses. If anyone else has any input, please feel free to send that along. And because of that, I probably won't be in on the TeamSpeak next week, since I will be in Boston at the meeting. W2NAF, back to net.
Fine business, Nathan. And next on the list, we have Tom, N5EG. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, good evening, Dave, and good evening to everybody on the group. Been a quiet week, lots of fun holiday events and things to attend to, so minimal work on the project. Back to you.
Fine business. And next on the list, we have Scotty, WA2DFI. Go ahead, Scotty.
Okay, thank you much, Dave, and thanks for running the show, as usual. And yeah, this week is has been kind of a holiday wind down, and not a lot going on. Still not feeling too well from the last couple of weeks, and it's not because of partying. So anyway, I did get a lot of work done on the data engine. I'm really down to pretty much the clocking and the power supply. Those are the last two things on the list to complete, and everything else is pretty much in place. See, I was going to ask a question here. In the original spec, we had a Wi-Fi module within the unit, and I'm thinking that maybe that's not what we want to do. That's kind of a waste of time, because if we're going to have a single board computer, it's going to have Wi-Fi on it. So there's not really much point in putting a Wi-Fi module on this board. Most of the modules, the low-cost modules, are designed for IoT applications, so they might be good for doing some control, but they're not really good for streaming any data anyway. So I'm having trouble deciding. So I might like opinions whether it might be better just to leave it off and not bother with it. And not only that, I'm running short of I/O. If you can believe, we have 500 IOs, and I'm out already. So it's kind of amazing. Anyway, that's it for here. So back over to you, Dave.
Fine business, Scotty. And next on the list is Bill, AB4EJ. Go ahead, Bill.
Well, thanks, Dave, and good evening to you, and good evening to the net. Been quite busy here working on the project. I've defined or selected a something called WT Forms to use with Flask, and it works very well with helping to pre-cleanse your input when you're using web input, and it works very well with Flask, and that's what we use to control the local host. So I've been making some progress with that. Also, been doing some work with trying to convert everything over to use UDP, and what it seems like is that every bit that it makes the development of the every little thing that makes the development of the data engine easier as far as the software seems to make the programming on the local host more challenging. So I'm getting involved with all kinds of things dealing with the threading, and it seems like things are a little bit different with UDP than they are with TCP. And so taking into account a lot of other things I hadn't thought about before. So making slow progress, slow, very frustrating progress on that, but it is coming along. So when we come to the open discussion area, I'll talk with Scotty a little bit about the some things that I've figured out regarding that. So back to net.
Fine business. And next on the list, we have Dan in for XWE. Go ahead, Dan.
Good evening, Dave, and hello, everyone. I did get my Vim3 board up and running, and it runs just about the same with the IQ2 as the Odroid N2 board. And that's, on balance, not very well. I think the problems are with the fact that we're using a fairly high sampling rate for the audio. It's 384K, and that alone seems to cause problems. The thread scheduling in Ubuntu Mate is also pretty awful, to say the least, and I'm not sure if there's a way to go in and control the threads a little bit better, but they all seem to run on the same core, or at least the ones that use a lot of CPU run on the same core, and that's not very good. I mean, I actually have cases where the one core is running about 74% and the other five cores are running about maybe in the teens. So it just doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. There's not much I can do to control things. Let's see, what else? I guess that's about it. I have been listening somewhat successfully to the AWRL code practice with my little indoor long wire antenna, and the reception here is pretty good. And if I turn my display refresh rate down to 1 frame per second, the absolute lowest it will go, and when HPSVR, the audio is actually fairly decent, much above that in frame rate, and the audio starts degrading pretty rapidly. Anyway, back to you, Dave.
Say, Dan, I tried using the Odroid and with different speeds with my Hermes and Raspberry Pi or Red Pitaya, and also I have two Metis setups. And once I get above, you know, once I get up to 384, I do get pops on this one as well with Lin HPSDR. So I don't think it's the software, because when I run that on a full machine, I don't have any problem. And of the little single board computers, the NVIDIA seems to be the best as far as the NVIDIA Nano. But even with it, if you crank it up, it will start to pop. Anyway, that brings us to the end of the list, so we're open for general discussion.
So Dan, what does it do when you say it doesn't work very well? Is it just clicks and pops, or is it worse than that?
It clicks and pops, and it's worse than that. It just gets all distorted and really pretty messy. But like I said, when I turn the frame rate on the video down to the lowest setting, it actually, the audio runs pretty well.
Because I'm running on the same board as you are, and you've got the 4 gig model, I presume, the higher, the fancier one. And it, I hear clicks and pops, but I can turn the frame rate up to 10, and I don't see appreciable difference between 1 and 10. And the CPUs are all around 50% or less.
Is that with the N2 or with the VIM3?
That's with the VIM3.
Okay, well, it is a little bit better with the VIM3, but it's still not good enough for prime time.
But just because of the clicks and pops, I mean, it doesn't freeze up or anything, right?
Well, I actually have had Lin HPSDR freeze up 2 or 3 times. I'm not so sure that that was a function of the VIM3 board. That might have been something else. I don't know.
Yeah, because I've never heard mine get all fuzzy and not understandable. You know, you get the occasional clicks and pops, but it's, and probably, I'm not sure quite why you would get clicks and pops when there's no CPU above 50%, but it seems to do it.
Well, I get clicks and pops even when I run it on my Linux box. I have like an AMD, like a half, it's the one that we ran the IQ2 on in the lab there for quite a while. And that one actually clicks and pops a little bit, although I can raise the frame rate up to, you know, whatever number, and it doesn't seem to affect it much. I still get clicks and pops at a 1 frame per second rate.
Well, that's like an AMD A10. That's a pretty powerful processor.
Yeah, it is. It's really one of the nicer machines I've ever built. And I also ran it with PowerSDR in Windows, and I have no clicks and pops. So I don't think it's really a hardware thing. It's more of an OS thing.
Have you tried any of the facilities for, well, I don't know, maybe you don't, you can't, if it's all in one application, you can't set the processor affinities more evenly across the processors.
No, that's something I haven't tried, Dave, and I probably ought to school myself a little bit on how to do that and go ahead and give that a shot. I mean, it's pretty obvious in looking at the processor loads that overloading the cores is the root cause of the problems.
You might not be able to, you certainly can set individual applications, you can set the affinities, but whether how you go about setting, I'm sure there's a way to set individual threads and stuff to associate with specific processors. I'm not so sure. That's a little more advanced than I've ever looked into.
Yeah, same here. I mean, generally speaking, thread loading or thread scheduling is rarely a big issue in Linux.
Hey, Dave, do you think you might have some hardware, a hardware board for me to take to Hamcation by beginning of February?
I can make a point of doing that. I certainly have something I can give you. I have two variants of the board, and the ones, but the complete one, I've been working with the software, so I haven't worried about the I2C extender part for the moment, just because it's so hard to solder those on the board. But the other part, I certainly have those, and I can make a point of getting one of the others together if I can.
Yeah, we don't need one that to actually set up a working demo, but it would be cool to just show one.
I've definitely got that.
Okay, very good, because it's I'm going to be flying out on the 5th of February, so have to get here before then, but we got some time for that.
You'll need to get me some information on where to send it to. I don't think I have your address or anything, so if you could email me your particulars, that would be very helpful.
Okay, I can do that.
All right, if nobody has anything else they're wanting to talk about at the moment, this is Bill, AB4EJ. Wanted to touch base with Scotty regarding the what we're going to do now and what we're going to do later, probably going to be two different things, but I did want to talk to you about you had mentioned that there is a dream of having multiple data engines and multiple local hosts on the wire, and I wanted to talk to you about that a little bit.
Okay, good. Yes, you see problems, or is it possible?
Well, what we do for phase one and what we do eventually could probably be two different things. Of course, the simplest case is where you have a single data engine and a single local host. The data engine is listening for discovery packets, like with the current Medicine Hermes kinds of systems. The local host sends out, in other words, broadcasts a discovery packet. Everything that's on the wire, in this case, one thing, answers back and says, here I am, here is the type of radio I am, and here is my IP address. All right, so that is the simplest case. So now from then on, what I can do is I know to direct my control commands to that IP address, so the data engine gets the control commands, like such as set channel so-and-so to center bandwidth of center frequency of so-and-so with a bandwidth of so-and-so. Now here, start collecting data, and the data engine will just broadcast the data, and it just goes out to everything that can see it on the wire, but I can see what IP address it's coming from, and I can collect it at the local host. So that's a simple case. Now, then the next case that you come to is, if you have two data engines on the same network and one local host, when I do a broadcast from the local host, both data engines will answer, and I get them both. I know their IP addresses, and I can pick one of them to work with. All is good so far. The complexity starts coming in when you have a many-to-many situation. Let's start with the simplest case of that, where I have a single data engine and two local hosts on the wire. So the data engine is listening. When I fire it up, local host number one does a discovery. Data engine says, here I am. So now the local host number one has its IP address. Local host number two does a discovery. Data engine says, here I am. And he's got the IP address. Now the question begins to be, how do we control a data engine so that the two local hosts are not trashing what each other's are trying to do? And as you can imagine, if you have multiple data engines and multiple hosts, this problem of knowing who's in control of what starts becoming quite dramatically escalated. In other words, then I'm going to have, if you broadcast from a data engine, I'm going to have to take a look at where this data is coming from to decide whether I want to use it or if it's something for somebody else on the wire. Now, I suppose all of those things can be done eventually, I suppose. but I don't think, unless somebody can tell me this is a lot easier than I think it is, I don't think we necessarily want to shoot for that right out of the gate. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I think in the second scenario, the last scenario, where you have two local hosts and one data engine. So the first local host is going to do a discovery, the data engine is going to say, I'm going to respond. Here's my IP address and a port number. And that's where you send the configuration commands. And then when the second local host does a discovery, the data engine is going to send out obviously his own IP address, but he's going to send out a different port number because he sees that the request came from a different IP address. So now it's the same IP address on the data engine, but there are two different ports. So each local host has his own port that the data engine is listening on. Does that help solve some of the problem?
Well, yeah, maybe. But it doesn't tell me how to decide which local host has the privileges of doing what. Because if local host number one says start data collection, and then local host says host two and starts getting it, and local host two says stop data collection. Now all of a sudden, local host number one, his data supply gets cut off. Did we really envision the data engine being able to serve multiple hosts like this?
Yeah, actually I do. And here's the way you get around that, I think. And this is an extra layer, which you're probably not going to like, but we can talk about maybe not implementing it out of the gate. But what the idea is that the IP address and the port number that are given back to the local host in response to a discovery, and that channel is used merely to establish channel pairs. And the channel pairs are, again, different ports on the same IP address, but they are assigned to establishing a stream and the stream itself. So the idea is you would establish a control channel for a stream, and then that control channel would be used to establish the stream, and that control channel would be used to start and stop the stream, and it would be used to control only aspects of that particular stream, like the data width and the sample rate and all that. And the idea would be is that the resources are really, I would say, first come, first serve. So if the localhost one says, fire up ADC1 and give me a stream, and then localhost two says fire up an ADC, and the data engine only has one ADC, then he would just give a NAC back and say, I can't do that. There's no resources available to do that.
Well, tell me again the concept of a channel. Run that by me again.
Okay, so there's three types of communications. I call them channels, but all it really means is a IP address and a port number. That defines a channel. That's where somebody's listening for commands. So the discovery channel, all of the data engines listen all the time. And then once a successful discovery occurs, then the local host is going to establish a command channel. So I call it the configuration channel is the discovery channel and the subsequent setting up of command channels. Now you go through discovery. That gives you a configuration channel. That basically is a place that the data engine is listening to take configuration commands. The configuration commands you use to establish a control stream, which is basically another IP, another port address on the same IP on the data engine. And you use that to establish a stream of whatever type you want or whatever direction you want. And so that the commands... So you got configuration commands used to define a command channel, and then the commands go out over the command channel, and the command channel sets up the streams, and the streams are UDP streams with no ACK that just spew data out to the IP addresses that they
User
were told
entered
to.
Your channel.
So I don't know if I'm explaining it very well or not, but the idea is then if I want a second receiver, say, from that same data engine, I would open another command channel and use that command channel to open another stream, which could be a different data rate, different center frequency, different width. It has its own parameters.
Okay, so, all right. So IP address and port summon. So the first is the discovery, then is configuration, and after that is the data stream. Those are the three channels. Do I understand you correctly?
Well, it's discovery, which establishes a configuration channel. That single configuration channel is used to establish multiple command channels, And each command channel can be used to establish a data stream of whatever type of parameters you want, whatever kind of frequency or characteristics you want. So if in our case, with the data engine, if he's going to have 8 virtual receivers, you would actually use the configuration channel to open 8 command channels. And then each one of those command channels would open a data stream. And again, they could all be different widths, different data rates. They're all independent.
Okay. Well, this isn't going to be something that's going to be achieved quickly. That's for sure. I'm having enough trouble getting one channel working. We'll document that and set that up for when we get to it. But I don't know that we're necessarily going to achieve that for phase one. But we will certainly lay the groundwork so that it can be done when we have a chance.
Yeah, and that's all I'm asking is to make sure that we have the ability to do it at some point and don't box ourselves in so that, like we did with Protocol 2, where you can't do it.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, that doesn't exactly answer it, but I know what I'm faced with. So I had a question also for Dan. What computer are you using? You said you had something that you thought was maybe more powerful than an Odroid.
Right. We have a Vim 3, which is a little bit different processor and a little different architecture that we're using.
What, Victor India Nancy Vim 3?
Victor India Mike.
It is very similar, though.
Yeah, for what I'm doing here, I don't know whether it, unless it's the dramatically more powerful, I'm not sure that it would make a whole difference to the data acquisition task. Although, you know, I could see how maybe if you're doing a lot of really wideband stuff. So, Dan, you said that you're running, or what are you running OpenHP SDR on it to talk to one of the SDRs?
I'm actually using LinHP SDR. It's a John Melton Linux client.
Right. And so, you're seeing clicks and pops during receiving what, say, in like 40 meters, for example, or what? What are the operating parameters?
Well, it's pretty universal. Actually, on 40 meters, it runs reasonably well as far as receiving is concerned, but the audio is pretty awful.
And that is using what computer, rather, which radio, which software-defined radio?
It's the IQ2 that iQuad Labs does.
Okay,
It's HP SDR Protocol 1.
Yeah, okay, well, I'm just coming up to speed on I haven't been this deep into the SDRs until now, so I'm making sure that I have a handle on what everybody's using. So, thanks. I don't think I have any further questions at this moment.
The other thing,
like a Hermes board.
Yeah, the other thing to remember is it's running at 384K.
Yes, and while Hermes is adjustable downward to lower sample rates, the IQ2 firmware hasn't been updated for that feature yet.
When I do the same thing with Hermes, down at below 384, there's no problem. It runs fine. But as you go above it, there's problem with the Odroid. But then when I hook it to my tower, I can crank it up. My Hermes that's running Protocol 2 can go up to 15 million.
1536?
Yes.
768 times 2, right?
Yes.
Well, 768 times 2 would be 1.5 meg, right?
Yeah, that's the highest that the Hermes on Protocol 2 will run. With Lin HPSDR, it doesn't play that very well.
Yeah, it's 1536K sample, so 1.536 meg.
But running at the lower rates, everything seems to work fine. And I had I did have a working iQuad too, but right now the power supply is down.
Yeah, and I told you what I found there, right?
Yeah, I don't know what happened, but it was inside the metal box when it stopped working.
That's pretty weird because the FL1 came off the transmitter board in pieces.
Did you find another one?
Yep, I got one and I've replaced it and I've fired it up and the 5-volt supply is working now. So I think I'll send it back to you and let you plug it in and do the testing.
Okay, well, that sounds good.
The only thing I can think of is if the 5-volt supply was overloaded, but you know, then your HF2 wouldn't work either. Have you run the HF2? You've run that with a B micro, right?
Here's the deal. Normally inside the box, it's the A9, but I did get into the B micro, but I had came back, taken the B micro and reprogrammed it for the HF2 because it doesn't work with the HF1 at all.
Oh yeah, that's right. We talked about that last week. Well, you know, if you plug the HF2 onto the CVA9 in the IQ2 and you feed 5 volts in to the HF2 on this connector, on this power connector, it will power the CVA9 off of that and it'll actually want to run as a receiver in that configuration.
Okay, I was trying to figure out what exactly to put on the, you know, it's 5 volts and is there an amperage expectation?
Yeah, I think it's about 800 mils. And you can use one of those jacks, those plugs that I gave you. I think you just feed power right into the HF2.
Okay, well, I'll try that. I was a little confused on that, and I didn't want to fry another board.
Yeah, all the 5 volts are in parallel, which is really a bad way to do it. But by the time we got down to the TX2, we were grasping at ways to make a transceiver. So there's a few shortcuts we had to take. And then since all those connectors were hanging off the edges of the board, when we put them in the IQ2 case, we can't really cover them up, so we had to leave them hanging out. So now on the IQ2, there's 2 5-volt inputs and a 12-volt input. So you're probably wondering which ones to use, what one or the other to use.
Yep. That's it.
So, Tom, I think I've got some pages on the DE for you to review if you got some time to take a look at them.
Yes, now would be a good time to send them.
And we just want to make sure that they marry up okay with the RF board. And then go over the RF board with a fine-tooth comb. Do you think we're ready to start a layout on it?
I don't know what else to do to it. And so probably, I wish I had confidence that it, you know, was going to work right the first time. But I don't see anything wrong with it at the current time. So I'd say, yeah, we're ready to start layout once I check over the DE schematic.
Yeah, so I get you those, at least those to start with, those pages that have the connector on them, so we can make sure at least when you plug it in, it'll be connected up. And what I did is I put the direction of the IOs as little comment arrows next to the pin on the connector, so we can kind of confirm that that's the proper direction. And so perhaps you can do that on the data engine. And that, I mean, on the RF module, and that will, because mine are programmable, so they're all bi-directional. But in the DE case, I mean, in the RF module case, there's going to be a particular direction that they need to be for that board. So we need to program the FPGA to go that direction.
Okay. I think all of that is covered in the ICD for the receiver.
Okay. But I like little notes on the schematic, if I can fit them in. I don't want to clutter it up too much, but it's always nice, because especially like when you see a signal like TXD, well, which TXD is it? Is it at the transmitter end or at the receiver end?
Yeah, the names, we tried to be pretty descriptive on the names, and the ICD will, you know, define the name, define the direction, whether it's single-ended or differential, what the voltage is it an input, is it an output? Do we need to hash all that and come up with some kind of coded string that we put on each signal, or for a block of signals? How do you want to do that?
Well, the way I did it is I just put a text arrow on the signal showing which direction it goes out or into the connector.
Okay, but that, you know, that's an output or an input, but, you know, there's other things. What's the voltage on it? Is it single-ended or differential? Those matter as well.
Yeah, they do. And I think, you know, the ICD is maybe good for that. Or you know, when you have a signal name with ending in P and the same exact signal ending in N, that kind of pairs those signals together, right?
Yeah, and we tried to do that on the connector. So the connector names try to handle all that. But let me, when you send me what you've done, I'll try to copy that onto the receiver schematic.
Okay, very good. And then at some point, I want to take the receiver schematic and take ownership of it and go through it and check to make sure it meets all of our standards here and all that. And then I send it back to you and it'll be yours again. So pass the baton back and forth.
Okay, very good. Whenever you're ready, no problem.
But I want to make sure we know what we're doing, because if we both make changes to the schematic at the same time, we get hopelessly lost. And it's so what me and the CAD guy do, since he has ORCAD also, I'll send it to him and say, okay, your ball's in your court. You have it. I won't touch it. Even if he makes comments to me, I won't touch it. He owns the schematic at that point. Then he makes any changes that he's going to make. And then he sends it back to me and says, okay, now it's your ownership now. And any changes that I didn't make, and by the way, here's the changes I made. And anything else that you need to make now, you can go ahead and do it because the ownership is yours. So it's like passing the baton back and forth.
Okay, very good. That's the whole reason, I guess, folks use revision control systems.
Yeah, and then we can get, we have a pretty good idea of the outline. So we could start with, the way he'll start is with a read-in, which means he gets all the decals correct. And then after that, he's going to depend on us to tell him where to put stuff.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of detailed requirements on where stuff gets laid out.
Yeah, and this guy's really good. So I think if you've got time, sometime during the day in the next few weeks, we can meet with him on, he does Turbo Meeting, which is kind of like a Skype call, but it's more technical, and he shares his screen. And typically we do a telephone for voice, and we can take a look at the layout, and we can make real-time suggestions, and he can move stuff around and show us what will work and what won't work. And he wants to understand what it is that we want so he can give us the right layout.
Okay. Yeah. We're going to have at least one of those. And I'm going to guess maybe two or three, probably the first one will be generally, where do we want stuff? And then he'll mock something up and then we'll review it. So I'm going to guess we'll go through that loop a couple times.
Yeah, because he'll know where the 140 pin connector is and where the SMAs are, but everything else, he's not going to have any clue as to where we want them.
Yeah, I've got very specific requests on the relays. And, you know, where are the coil pins? Where are the signal pins in with respect to the ground planes? You know, some are over the ground plane, some are not over the ground plane. You know, there's all kinds of things like that we're going to need to talk over.
Yeah, and you have specific ideas where you want the planes, right?
Oh, yeah. There's three ground planes, and we have to assure that there's non-overlap between power and ground planes in some places and full overlap in other places. So we've got, there's quite a long list of stuff I'd like to see if we can do.
So have you done a basic figuring on how many layers you think it's going to take?
No, I don't know. The key is I don't know how dense the wiring can get into and out of the big ICs and the giant edge connector. And I feel that, however dense those are is going to determine the number of layers.
Yeah, okay. And then we're doing differential, so he's got to match the pairs together, right? And he's got to match the individual pairs with all the rest of the pairs, right?
Yeah. These, they've got to, there's blocks of 8 differential signals or 16, I forget the number, maybe it's 13 differential signals, where the timing has to line up across them, although I don't think it's incredibly critical, but they'll have to be, you know, reasonably well matched. And of course, the individual signals of the differential pair have got to be extremely well matched.
Yeah. So on each RF module, we have 17, two sets of 17 inputs and one set of 14 outputs. So I'm expecting there's three groups there, and each one of those groups will be able to select the VDDI voltage for.
Yeah, I'm going to have to bring up the schematic. It depends on if we're operating in LVDS mode at 244 megahertz clock rate, double data rate, or if we're running CMOS So that, you know, depending on which way it's laid out, it could be different. I think if we lay it out for LVDS, it'll probably work okay for CMOS.
Yeah, and I think, I'm trying to think, I haven't connected up the FPGA pins. I haven't allocated them yet because I'm right at the limit of how many I'm going to have. So that's going to be the last fun part. But to do LVDS, it seems to me that, so we can do 1.8 volt CMOS, but to do LVDS, I think we need either 2.5 or 3.3 volts on the VDD IO of the FPGA. So we have to, we're going to be able to strap that to whichever of the three voltages we need to program the board to do what we want. So, and do you remember the inputs, the 1.8 volt inputs are 3.3 volt compatible on that A to D, right?
The A to D, the LVDS outputs are driven from a 1.8 volt power supply. So the differential signaling swing on the P line, it cannot exceed 1.8 volts, and the signaling on the other line can't exceed 1.8 volts. So it's intended to go to 1.8 volt logic. The inputs, the only really high speed input is the clock line to the A to D converter, and that's AC coupled.
Okay, so we could run that on 3.3 volts then.
I think there could be problems. That chip is expecting 1.8 volt signals on the clock lines. And so, but the way I have it, it comes from the connector, it's terminated in a 100 ohm resistor, and then there's a 0.1 into the clock plus and a 0.1 into the clock minus on the A to D chip. And so I would think you would probably want to drive that with 1.8 volt LVDS signals.
Okay, yeah, so this will be a touchy point that we'll have to deal with on the data engine to make sure that we can strap the voltages in the right groups to get everybody happy with the right voltage. Because I think what's going to end up happening is each RFM connector is going to be, you're going to pick a voltage for it, 1.8, 2.5, or 3.3, and then all of the 34 inputs and 14 outputs will be that voltage, but the control voltages will be not necessarily the same. They may be able to be strapped to a separate voltage, because it seems like the clocks, well, for certainly like the ID pins and all that, you're going to want to do 3.3 volts for them.
Yeah, there are 3.3 volts required for the SCL and SDA signals, so the I2C controls. The SPI controls are 1.8 volts, and then the so all the signals, I believe, on the receiver connector that I can see, anything that wiggles is either 1.8 volts, which is the vast majority of them, or 3.3 volts on like four of them.
Yeah, and those four are like the common I2C type pins, so they can be just kept at 3.3 always.
Yes, exactly. So there's just four pins that are I2C, and I believe every other pin that wiggles is a 1.8 volt pin.
Okay, good. So that makes it easy. The clocks and the LVDS lines will be all 1.8 or strappable, so we can set them to 1.8, and then the other ones will just be fixed at 3.3. So, but we'll have to make sure and check all that so that we don't shoot ourselves somewhere.
Yeah. The clock requirements to the A to D chip are pretty critical, and so I'm going to guess it is not tolerant of overdrive.
Yeah, you probably get lots of overshoot if you try to go above the protection diodes in the part.
Yeah, it's terminated in its characteristic impedance, and because you don't want ringing on the clock lines, and so the clock lines internally bias themselves to about 0.9 volts, and so if you have a 1.8 volt signal swing, then what comes out of the capacitor ought to be ground to 1.8 volts.
Yep, and anything above 1.8 then goes below ground.
Yeah, or something weird happens, but the clock line, which is the only high speed signal line going from the data engine to the receiver, That one's the critical signal. If we garf up those two lines, the received performance will suffer.
Yep. Understood. Okay. So it was easy. Anyone could do it, right?
Exactly.
So Dave, KV0S, I've started using a little different client for measuring process percentages. It's called HTOP, Hotel Tango Oscar Papa. And it runs as a command line program. It's very lightweight, and it does a lot better job than the little system window thing that is the normal installation for Linux. You do have to install it separately, but it's available in Ubuntu without any problems. And that seems to give me a little bit better view of what's going on with the CPU.
Yes, I use that. I use the system one when I'm lazy, but I do use HTOP quite a bit because it's command line. It's easier to slip in there and work with it and see what the loads are and everything.
Yeah, Dan, I think there's also a utility called ITOP, which may provide a similar functionality for the interfaces, the Ethernet interfaces.
There's a TOP as well.
Yeah, TOP comes bundled with the system, at HTOP is nice, and it'll show you by core what's going on. And I don't think I've tried ITOP, but I recall seeing ITOP. You know, if you're trying to figure out who's using up your Ethernet interface, I think ITOP will help you.
Oh, if you have multiple users?
Yeah, if you have one Ethernet interface and you got 10 processes trying to talk to it, I think it'll help you understand which process is using what percentage of that interface.
I have not used ITOP, but I have used the others.
Oh, I'm in Windows right now. I can't fire it up and tell you. Let me do a quick web search.
So I placed a link down there at the bottom, and it's to a dual band Wi-Fi module. But my concern is that if I just place that hook it up to the FPGA, I'm not going to really be able to do anything with it because it's looking for like a TCP/IP stack to drive it, and I don't really have that in the FPGA. So anybody have any opinions?
I would say if you can't figure out a use for it, it may be one of those things to, I know you like the flexibility, but if you can't see a firm use, and I don't think you need multiple control channels unless you do, it might be a good one to cut.
Well, I can see a firm use, but I'm not sure I have a realistic expectation of how hard it'll be to get it to work. Because if it's meant to really hook on to a microprocessor and run a bunch of software to drive it, then that's not going to be what we want. But if it's a lot of these modules have microprocessors in them, so they do the TCP/IP stack or a lot of the software overhead inside the part, and you just get like a serial port for command.
Yeah, I can't. I thought maybe somebody else can jump in here, but. I can't see that the redundancy is that valuable. At one time we were talking about looking at other ways to send data, but I don't think that's one.
Yeah, I was thinking more like a way to stream Bluetooth audio or to control the radio with your phone in the cases where there may be no single board computer involved. But it says it's based on the Atheros QCA9377 SoC. You know, this sounds like a chip that you stick on the bus in your Linux system and then you use Linux to drive it. And that's going to be way beyond the capability of what I'm going to want to be able to do in the FPGA.
Okay, I have a correction. The command is IFTOP, not ITOP, but IFTOP.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah, ITOP actually looks at the interrupts and gives you an idea of what's going on with interrupts.
Okay, so just missed a little F there. Anyway, IFTOP will give you a biprocess. Who's consuming which bandwidth?
There does appear to be an ITOP because I just installed it, but I don't know what it is.
Yeah, I think it's a way to look at your interrupts and find out what interrupts are doing at the current time.
So, Scotty, I'm sorry, can you go back again? And you were saying, what was the part that you were debating whether or not you needed to add?
It was a Wi-Fi and Bluetooth module. And this particular one I found, which is a dual band Wi-Fi module and a Bluetooth 4.1. We can put it on the bus, and hardware-wise, we can connect it up, but I have no idea what software support is going to take to actually operate the thing. And, you know, if it's going to take a whole bunch of software to run it, it's going to be beyond the scope of what we want to put in the FPGA, so there's really no point in putting it on the board then, if that's the case.
Yeah, I think if there's not a really clear path forward with that one, I think I'd leave it off. I know, like, if I were, you know, if I were getting this device and I saw, oh, there was Wi-Fi on it, I'd want to stream IQ data over that almost right away. And, you know, it's, we don't really have the bandwidth to do that, or it's just not going to perform as well as having the gigabit Ethernet. So if it's going to add that much complexity and confusion, I think leaving it off is okay.
Well, simple to hook it up physically, but it's there's more to making something work than just hooking the wires up. So and I'm not sure what it is. I was hoping someone here might know a little bit, but I know on the Ultra 96 board, and I believe on some of the line boards, they have Wi-Fi chips. And I wish Rob was here. He knew more about the Kiwi board. I think the Kiwi board, the interface is a web interface directly off of the board, if I'm not mistaken.
I really think the Wi-Fi thing, from what my opinion's worth, is a can of worms that you don't need.
So if you want Wi-Fi, get it off your single board computer, right?
Yeah, and even there's enough voodoo involved with when these SBCs first come out with newer chipsets about whether they have whether the driver is fully supported or conflicting with some other function on the chipset of the main board. It always seems to be a struggle around that one thing. And I would let them work it out and not get into that here.
Yeah, because I'm looking at the webpage for the hardware, and they have some documentation on drivers for Linux and that kind of thing. So that kind of says to me that this is a module that would be used to place on a single board computer if you're making one of those, and then you would use Linux to drive it.
I really don't think that many people are looking at putting, except for very, very, very modest uses, putting Wi-Fi directly into bare metal coded option boards of any sort.
Yep, so it sounds like we can save the space and the expense of that. So I'll look around a little bit more, but I'm kind of leaning in that way too, because most of the cheap Wi-Fi modules, they're very low throughput. You can't, like Nathaniel says, you can't stream IQ data through them. You can't even stream audio through them. They're like a UART interface. So even though they go relatively fast, it's not really the kind of thing where you're going to be streaming data. It's going to be some kind of control channel.
Yeah, we may want to focus on Wi-Fi as the interface from the single board computer out to the internet, you know, maybe through a home router or a home Wi-Fi access point, because I think the performance there is nowhere near as critical a requirement as the LAN that connects the single board computer and the data engine. And I think the Linux OSs can handle having Wi-Fi be a WAN port and the gigabit Ethernet being a LAN port in terms of firewall rules and routing and all of that kind of stuff.
So again, would you be sending just commands over the Wi-Fi and not streaming data?
No, you would stream data from the, you know, from the single board computer up to the central server, you know, located, you know, over the internet a number of states away. And, you know, that's limited by your internet bandwidth. So if you have a 5 meg internet stream, you can't be pumping data faster than 5 megabits per second over that stream.
Okay. And that's because it's a low speed stream that you can use Wi-Fi, because it's much more speed challenged than gigabit Ethernet is.
Yeah, and latency isn't really important because the internet as a whole is going to have, you know, hundreds of milliseconds of latency. And so the Wi-Fi latency is immaterial. The Wi-Fi speed is really not material. You're trying to upload the saved 15-minute or the condensed piece or whatever, you know, that you've previously saved. And so that interface doesn't really need the performance that you want on the interface between the data engine and the SPC.
Wi-Fi would be perfectly adequate for rather what we call the snapshotter mode, where it's sending up a pre-processed FFT of the selected band area once per second, along with magnetometer and a few other things like that. That would be perfectly fine to do that with Wi-Fi.
Yeah, and I think if we do that, then you know we solve the security and the firewall issues at the same time.
But again, that's Wi-Fi on the single board computer that we don't really need it on the data engine, right?
Exactly.
I think I also like that architecture where, again, the data engine is really supposed to be the radio, and the single board computer is the control and the in out of the whole system. So I think keeping the Wi-Fi on the single board computer sticks with that architecture better.
Yeah, and I've really been trying to not garbage up the data engine with a bunch of analog in and out and parallel I/O and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think that's the way to do it.
I've looked at the issue of how to do Wi-Fi with the Odroid, and the only solution they have is a plug-in USB Wi-Fi adapter. That is Odroid's official way of doing that. There may be other ways, but I haven't found them.
Yeah, there another possibility is that you can buy a USB to Ethernet adapter. They're not very expensive. And you know, it doesn't have the performance that you'd want for a Gig E, but it would have adequate performance as the interface between the SPC and the outside internet.
Oh yeah, that would be really a splendid idea. Given that we are have so much concern with security, that would allow us to use the firewall capabilities of the OS on the Odroid.
Yeah, that was
So,
my. Yeah, go ahead, Scotty.
I was going to say, did I miss something? I thought, didn't you and Bill just suggest the same exact thing, or did I mishear one?
No, I think I probably said the same thing that Tom just said. I mean, I'm trying to do two or three things at the same time here, so I tend to miss things. I do it anyway, even when I am trying to concentrate.
No, you were first. You said a USB to Ethernet port, and then Tom jumped in and said the same thing. Is it that is what you said, right, Bill?
What I meant, I was trying to say a USB to Wi-Fi port, but anyway, I think the use of USB to Ethernet adapter is really the way to go.
Okay, I misunderstood then. So you were saying USB to Wi-Fi, and Tom's saying USB to wired Ethernet.
Yes.
Yeah, well, I think you can do either, depending on the requirements. If if you need Wi-Fi and the SPC doesn't have it, you could use the USB to Wi-Fi adapter. If you have an SPC that has one Ethernet and zero Wi-Fi, you could use a USB to Ethernet and get, you know, two wired interfaces, one lower performing to the WAN, and then the standard normal one on the board for the LAN. So I think it gives you a number of inexpensive options.
Yeah, okay, good. And I'm reading on the Kiwi SDR page here and trying to figure out how they did their Wi-Fi web interface to the radio. And I looked at the schematic and I don't see any hardware there to do it. Well, they plug onto a BeagleBone, and the BeagleBone takes care of all of the Wi-Fi and the web browser, like the web server. So that's the way we ought to do it also.
Yeah, well, you know, we'll need to look at the capabilities of the SBC that we choose. And then, you know, we can find one of these inexpensive adapters if necessary. If the chosen SBC doesn't, you know, do what we need, we can use one of these inexpensive things to get the two interfaces.
Yeah, the USB 3 to Wi-Fi adapter. I mean, I've seen those for like $9.
Well, the probably more important consideration there is you will have the choice of several options, and which may be updated as time goes on, because the Wi-Fi you know, stuff is keeps changing anyway, and the bandwidth and the choice of router, you know, I mean, depending on which protocols it supports, those keep changing, and you won't get that if you hardwire it to your FPGA.
Yeah, and that was the whole point of using the resources on the single board computer is in 2021, when the N3 comes out, you want to use that one with the upgraded hardware. Okay, I think you guys convinced me.
Just a notification, we're past our time.
Yes, one quick question for Nathaniel. What does it look like for the when the hotel's arrangements are going to be able to be made? Is it coming up soon here, as soon as the web page opens? Or
Your hotel is being taken care of. So I spoke to the person today who's booking your arrangements, and she will be in touch with you shortly.
Oh, okay. So I will wait.
Yes, but it is in progress. And don't worry, you will have a place to sleep.
Yeah, I won't have to bring my tent.
Nope, we've got you covered. Don't worry.
It isn't, hey, well, you know, my brother. Go ahead, Dave.
I was wondering if it was a nice bench in the park.
Well, you know, my brother has a condo in Orlando that I get to use for hamcation. And I've been bugging him since November to make the reservation at the condo. And he keeps telling me, nobody makes reservations that far in advance. Don't worry. Everything's fine. Don't freak out. And I'm going like, hey, it's 3 weeks until the conference. And you haven't made the reservation. And I'm envisioning having to bring my tent to Hamcation.
At least it's warmer in Florida.
Yeah, that's true. And they have a lot of construction going on the overpasses downtown. So I could probably find a place to sleep down there.
Yeah, that might work.
Just remember, in Orlando, if you have donut glaze crumbs on you, that Orlando police test that, and it will show up in their system as crystal meth, and that's no joke.
Say what?
You would think that police officers would be able to tell the difference between donut glaze and crystal meth, because they probably have donut glaze on their uniform. But yeah, they busted some guy last week, some religious character just driving around town doing his thing, eating a donut, and they saw glaze on the floor of his car that had from a donut he had the previous week, and they accused him of having crystal meth and arrested him and everything else, and it turned out to just be donut glaze.
That's ridiculous.
At least he got a place to stay.
Well, well, he had a perfectly good home to live in, but if you're concerned about it, I wouldn't think that the Orange County prison is the greatest place to stay for Hamfest.
Yeah, probably not. It kind of takes the cation part out of Hamcation.